This content is for institutional investors and information purposes only. It does not contain investment, financial, legal, tax, or any other advice and should not be relied upon for this purpose. The materials are not tailored to your particular personal and/or financial position. If you require advice based on your specific circumstances, you should contact a professional advisor. Opinions expressed are those of the speakers as of the date of publication, are subject to change without notice, and do not necessarily reflect Mercer's opinions.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Raylan Lambert, and this is our February edition of our Critical Thinking, Critical Issues podcast. And today I am joined by three experts in our alternatives business, Billy Charlton, who'll speak to the private equity perspective, David Scopoletti, our head of private equity and private debt, offering his views on private debt in this session, and also Dave McMillan, our champion and lead of hedge funds in terms of how we implement hedge funds in portfolios for our clients around the world. So we're going to have a very interesting conversation today. First, I thought it would be helpful just to anchor the discussion before we dive into some of the more interesting nuances of our discussion. Billy, maybe you could start with just anchoring us. What role does private equity play in a broader portfolio?
Sure. Thank you, Ray. I appreciate that. The main driver in private equity is returns. Over the last 20 years, if you look back, the returns in private equity have been spectacular. And that's what really adds to the value of the portfolio. People talk about some mild diversification. I would argue that diversification, there is some of that there, but it's mitigated a little bit by the measurement issues within private equity. It's easy to overestimate the diversification because the correlations, or underestimate the correlations. But fundamentally, private equity companies are still exposed to the same macroeconomic risks and macroeconomic environment that public companies are. So there is some mild diversification, but the main driver is the returns at the end of the day.
And I would add, as we see the public markets shrink, if you're not investing in private markets, particularly private equity, you're missing a huge opportunity set of the investable universe.
I totally agree with that. If you look back over, again, the past 20 years, there's about a 50% decrease in public equity stocks. And so if you're not in private equity, you're missing a big part of the investment opportunity set. And that's critical.
And to add that point, Billy, that is right. If you look over the last 20 years, 25 years, there's been a reduction of 40, 50% in the number of publicly listed companies that investors can buy. And there's been a 500% increase in the number of private companies. So as you think about it, there are more companies accessing private markets for capital than accessing the public markets, which gets into another trend that's been happening over the last several years in private equity, where you have private companies staying private. Well, Billy, that might be something you'd like to talk to the audience about.
Yeah, no, thanks, David. Exactly right. What's happening now is you have this hierarchy that's developed within private equity, where you have someone invest in a company, $500 million fund invest in a company, then sell it off to another private equity group that may be, $2 billion, and they run it for 3 or 4 years and then sell it off to another group that's $10 billion. So you have this kind of hierarchy that never existed before. So a company can stay private for, 10, 20 years, make a lot of money and generate returns for investors without ever going public. And I think, if you look at kind of the cost, a couple of things. The cost of going public is so high now. That's number one. And the second part of it is the ability to change, the ability to adapt to changing market conditions is much different in the private markets than it is in the public markets. In public markets, you have to worry about quarterly calls, you have to record quarterly earnings statements. in private markets, your private equity people are owning a good chunk of the company. They're very involved in the company. They know what's going on. They don't have to have explanations that affect market valuations. They know exactly what's going on with the company.
Dave, let me just jump in. I think this is an interesting point because, you know, Dave, in the hedge fund space, I'd be curious now to a position where cash is actually yielding a return. And hedge funds historically, you know, you might look at them, you know, during periods of less volatility, more sort of beta-driven returns. Yeah, hedge funds serve a good risk mitigating role. But where do you see sort of the balance between alpha and risk mitigation and the role that hedge funds should be playing in client portfolios as we move forward today and, you know, through 2025?
Sure. Thank you, Raylan. I mean, simply stated, we are the classic diversifier. It is often said that hedge funds are not an asset class. We actually use that descriptor, frankly, for convenience purposes. But there's a lot of truth to it if you really kind of pick it apart. Across all traditional and alternative asset classes, you have specific risks and specific betas. We are not an asset class in that sense. We're actually investing across all the different asset classes, but doing so with unique strategies, such as selling short or using leverage or other tools not available. And so what you're able to do is to strip out those betas and deliver a low beta, a high alpha proposition. So effectively diversifying the two systemic risks that really dictate outcomes, that is equity market risk and interest rate risk. The end result is, as you say, a cash plus investment with cash no longer at zero. That becomes quite compelling as a diversifier and an absolute return generator.
Dave, one of the questions we get a lot before we shift maybe over to David on the private debt side is you know, the views that we have with respect to multi-strat being one category, and then the multi-PM or, you know, portfolio manager shops, maybe in a, what's our views on that? Are there certain things that the client should be on the lookout for?
Yeah, we certainly think so. And there's a couple of nuances that are at play here. So, hedge funds implement different strategies. We believe in a diversified approach because those different strategies perform better or worse depending on the capital markets environment. So diversification is key to high probability outcomes. There are some funds that implement multiple strategies simultaneously, multi-strategy, as you mentioned, as the name would suggest. The important thing to note is that is not true diversification, because each of those strategies or PMs, they're receiving the same paycheck. They're still the same business risk, and that can only be mitigated through different hedge fund businesses. Now, there is this, it's not a new phenomenon, but is the all the rage these days, and that is the multi-PM, multi-strategy, or pod shop, where you end up with hundreds of PMs, depending on implementation, ever-increasing fees to investors, and in some cases, ever-increasing leverage. And while it's difficult and dangerous to make generalizations, but we would suggest buyer beware. If you're going to go with one of those structures, understand what's the total fees, gross up the return. Are those returns realistic and reasonable and likely to persist, and how much risk is actually taken to generate them? What's the fee split between the manager and the investor? It's your capital that's put at risk. You should get appropriate reward for that. So we do think there are some of those structures that have solved for some of those problems, but we think you really need to don't simply buy the track record, figure out what risks you're willing to accept.
And Dave, I believe there's a paper that we issued recently on that. So I think that's for those of you that are tuning into this, you can find that our Mercer Insight Research community, quite an interesting piece. So David, I just picking up on one of the things that Billy said, you know, he started saying that the role of private equity in a portfolio is return generation. I would say, however, the returns for private debt have actually been quite good. You know, maybe this might be a little dated, but a few years ago, you could have, you know, a median, you could access a top quartile private debt manager and get the same sort of return that you would get for a median PE manager. I guess, what's your views on the role that private debt plays in portfolios today? And how are you thinking about returns as it relates to the asset class?
Sure. There's a lot of questions unpacked there. I mean, just as a refresher for everybody, since the great financial crisis, banks continue to lead both the private equity business and the private debt business. Many of the major banks globally were players, investors, either directly in private equity companies as equity investors, or private equity funds, or certainly lending money directly to companies globally. Given just the growth in private companies and some of the regulatory regime that's come into play post the great financial crisis, including some bank failures that we had in early 2023, the private credit market has taken up the demand from companies for capital. So there's been that continues to be a major shift and. In terms of where private companies are getting private debt or debt capital from, first and foremost. You know, from a return perspective, we issued a white paper about a year and a half ago, looking at private loans or private credit relative to both broadly syndicated loan and high yield market, which obviously are higher returning markets than, you know, your normal historic fixed income markets. And, you know, what we've seen is, you have a much higher ratio, Sharpe ratio with private debt. Private debt has generated at least 300 basis point premium to those markets over a very, very long period of time. So as investors think about adding private debt to that portfolio, what we've seen is investors typically will take an allocation away from fixed income, or we'll add maybe some other growth diversifier as part of that portfolio and put private debt there, not only as a diversification, being able to get exposure to a whole different set of companies they might not have seen exposure in their fixed income allocations, but they're going in for returns as well. I mean, private credit has held up, you know, very well from a return perspective. And when rates go down, which, you know, they will eventually, how much, I think, you know, it remains for both speculation and let's wait and see what happens. But I think we all generally know they'll come down at some point in time. I mean, the spreads that you see in private credit will continue to be there, you know, typically somewhere between, 500 and 700 over whatever the benchmark it is. If it's, you know, in Europe, SONIA, or here in the U.S., SOFR. So that's what we continue to see and we would expect going forward when it comes to the asset class.
So let's talk a little bit more about rates. Billy, in our 2024 considerations piece, I thought you had a very interesting take on the correlation or not between interest rates and private equity returns. Can you maybe just share a few of the learnings that we gleaned from that study?
Yeah, sure. One of the things I think that's been challenging, one of the questions we get from clients a lot right now is, are the golden days for private equity over? You know, you had essentially zero interest rates for the last 5, 10, 15 years. And interest rates have popped up. And are private equity firms still going to be able to generate the returns that they have been? I think part of that is a legacy issue. The beginning of private equity, you know, that's why they call them LBOs as opposed to what we call them buyouts now.
Leveraged buyouts.
Yeah. So the leveraged buyouts were really driven by, you know, the 80s and 90s kind of structures where you had conglomerates where you could raise capital. You know, you had conglomerates where you had groups of companies put together that had no sense, no reason to be put together. There's no synergy. There was no commonality between the companies. They were really built as a portfolio for the management companies. So that's why LBOs came about, where you raise money, you raise debt, and then you come in and you break these companies apart and you make more money breaking companies apart because there was value there that wasn't being realized. Now, what was interesting is, if you think about it, the LBOs were raised at a time where interest rates were 13, 14, 15%. You know, so these were not cheap deals to be done. Today, the real value is not in it's not a financial structuring issue. It's about value generation. So how do you take a company and increase its revenue, increase its EBITDA? You know, you start by, you know, it may be, and there's any number of dimensions here. And part of what we pay private equity managers to do is figure out what are the right levers to play. We don't know what those are personally, but they do. Is it distribution? Is it product development? Is it, you know, they're at, you know, is it improvement of the management company? Is it improvement of the product placement? There's any number of dimensions that private equity managers can do. It's the choice of what those choices, you know, what those options are, that is really what we pay private equity managers to do.
Yeah, and Billy, I think one of the key things that when I took away was that it's not necessarily, you can have, you know, in the early 2000s, you had a pretty high interest rate environment, but the returns are actually quite good. So, you know, to sum it up, we look at what you can control, what the manager can control. And a lot of that too is the exit outcome, the optionality that they have to pull those value creation levers and generate, you know, a solid exit. So I think we've got a couple of minutes left, and I just wanted to go maybe back to Dave and then to David and finally you, Billy. You know, there's been a lot of debate about, you know, the changing of an overall portfolio. Is it 80-20? It was the 80-20. And now is there, you know, this discussion around 40-30-30. In your optimal world, Dave, what would be the hedge fund, the perfect hedge fund allocation for a portfolio? And don't say it depends on the client. Okay, just let's all assume, let's say this is a client that has good cash. They'd have cash for operations. They have, you know, they've got this fund to play with. Okay, so let's move that aside. So all of us are level set there. What's the perfect allocation for hedge funds?
Sure. So, I remember fondly the days of 30-40% allocations before the global financial crisis, and those clients, by the way, were served very well during that period, but. Fast forward to today, and to be very direct with your question, if you're talking about a not-for-profit client, very long time horizon, let's think sort of 80-20 or 70-30 risk orientation, we would suggest use that liquidity horizon, take half of what you would otherwise put into fixed income, put that in the hedge fund. So that's 10 or 15%. Give yourself a return premium to the fixed income and a diversifier to both equities and interest rate risk, because while rates may come down, we all know they can go up as well. And so something that can mitigate the downside from both of those systemic risks and give you a semi-liquid profile, 10 to 15% makes a lot of sense to us.
All right. Now, so David, 10 to 15% of the portfolio is taken up by Dave and hedge funds. So what's left for private debt? How much should we dial up private debt?
We have model portfolios, and this does really get to investor and what type of return, risk and return they're looking to get. But typically, we're seeing 5 to 10% allocations for portfolios for private debt. And again, it depends on, single model portfolio and the strategic asset guidelines that have been set by, you know, that particular asset owner. But we've seen 5 to 10%. Really the core in terms of allocating to private debt. And by the way, not too dissimilar to private equity. If you look at private equity allocations, they're usually a minimum of 10%. Private equity has been around for 30 or 40 years, so there's a lot of data on that. And in fact, one of the things that we reported on earlier this year as part of our Global Investment Forum Tokyo, we're seeing more and more asset owners reach 20% as allocations to alternatives or private markets. So I think one of the predictions from large asset owners that we saw as part of the survey that we've looked at and some of our clients are telling us that they're moving toward 25 and 30% allocations to the private markets, given the historic outperformance relative to public markets, less volatility, and so forth and so on. So, you know, we're seeing some major shifts again as more companies stay private longer or stay private, period. And financial institutions that historically have provided capital to those private companies, you know, are shifting their business models, frankly.
And I do think too that where we saw when, you know, maybe 10 years ago, private debt, largely you'd see that sort of as a piece of a private equity portfolio. Now you're seeing sort of that 5% being separate from, given how much more nuanced the private debt asset class is. It's not just a distress for trading or, you know, what it was historically, you know, say 20 years ago. So yeah. I think so 5 to 10% private debt, 10 to 15% hedge funds. Billy, you know, are you seeing clients dialing up? Do you think they should be dialing up their private equity allocation?
We're definitely seeing that. Yeah. You know, we're kind of going into the Swenson model, you know, the endowment model, depending on, obviously, on liquidity. But we're seeing clients go to, you know, 10% seems to be a floor now as opposed to a cap. So now we're seeing people go 20, 30% very easily. And again, it depends on your cash flow needs and your liquidity. But private equity has been generating a nice cash flow series. You know, this past year wasn't particularly good in terms of distributions, but that was, I think, unusual. But we're seeing clients kind of go to a 20, 30% allocation to private equity. You know, that's very characteristic at this point. And, you know, so to David's point, it's capturing the investment opportunity set, you know, and that's where the market is at this point. And if you want to be exposed to the market, you have to ratchet up that aspect of it in your portfolio.
Excellent.
And Raylan, what I'd add to that is we're seeing also investors more and more getting into secondaries and co-investments. The secondaries business, not only private equity, private debt, infrastructure, real estate, has seen major growth, across all the asset classes. So I think, you know, investors are also using the secondaries market and co-investment market in a different way, shape, and form than they were really 5, 10, or 15 years ago. But those two segments have really come into their own. And, you know, as anytime we think about an allocation to private markets, we really need to also not only include the four major asset classes, but also secondaries and co-investments as a key fundamental component of that.
Well, Billy, David, and Dave, thank you for sharing your thoughts with all of us today. You've heard that we've got some interesting research out there and certainly more to come. Look out for our 2024 considerations paper. We've got a lot out there on private debt, some interesting research and the hedge fund space, and a plethora of insights as well across real assets and private equity. So thank you all for listening to this episode, and we'll speak again soon. Thank you.